This is Brian Cambria with news for the Western Slope, Friday, May 10th, 2013. May 10th. It was 154 years ago today that the Golden Spike was driven at Promontory Point north of Salt Lake City, completing the Transcontinental Railroad and linking the industrial might of the East with the resource-rich West, and thereby forever changing the landscape and sealing the fate of Native Americans. Now the news. State Highway 133 opened to two-way traffic Thursday night at 8 p.m. Colorado Department of Transportation rockfall contractor Yenter Companies has completed rock scaling, blasting of rock on the roadway, and much of the hauling away at the rockfall site at mile marker 29 near Paonia Reservoir. The roadway will remain fully open on Friday and through the weekend. Next week, possibly Monday through Friday, crews will continue work to load and haul away the remainder of the rock debris that was pushed to the ditch. This will require a single-lane closure. For information on the CDOT project and others statewide, the public may visit their website at cotrip.org. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that opponents of drilling in the 220,000-acre Thompson Divide area won a minor victory this week when SG Interests said it would relinquish a 2,500-acre lease outside of Redstone. SG said it won't submit an application to drill and develop the lease or ask that it be suspended. Instead, the company will let it expire on May 31st, saying it would forgo this development in the Coal Basin area outside of Redstone. In its announcement, the company said, quote, "As part of our discussions and continuing negotiations with area groups, including the Thompson Divide Coalition and Trout Unlimited, SG has recognized that compromises must be made with the community in the proposed development of our natural gas field in Pitkin and Garfield counties." Zane Kessler, executive director of the coalition, said the news is an important step in the right direction, but it's only one step, he said. The group has been seeking to purchase leases or otherwise persuade companies to give them up in the Thompson Divide area, which stretches roughly from Glenwood Springs to McClure Pass. SG Interest continues to hold more than 20,000 acres of federal leases in that area in the proposed Lake Ridge drilling unit. Since the deadly Listeria outbreak in 2011, Rocky Ford melon growers have taken steps to ensure safety. Luke Runyon reports.
Turn the other lights on the two.
Michael Hirakata walks across the concrete floors of his newly constructed cantaloupe packing shed, flipping light switches and tidying up.
A little dusty in here, but
the building sat dormant for months, quiet since the final cantaloupe from last season's harvest was washed and packed here in the fall.
So walk me through a little bit about what this will look like come harvest time.
Oh, this will look like an anthill. It's organized chaos.
A large empty water tank sits along a wall. Plastic rollers snake across the basin with spray nozzles positioned above. The setup is new. Before installing this system, Hirakata washed the cantaloupes with recycled water. Now fresh water hits the melon rind each time.
It takes about a minute to go through that washing process.
After they've been dried and cooled, each cantaloupe is labeled with a sticker and a barcode. When scanned, it tells you what date the product was packed, where it was packed.
And if they wanted to dig into the computer, you know, they could find out what field it came from.
Think of this packing shed as a food safety expert's dream. Hirakata was just in the planning stages of this new building when news started pouring in about the Listeria outbreak, with the epicenter at a farm 90 miles away. Suddenly, he had access to food safety researchers from around the country, ready and willing to give input on his new facility.
We could actually ask industry experts their advice on how to build a cantaloupe packing facility, and whereas before we probably would have just done what we thought was right, but we had a unique opportunity.
A unique opportunity born out of tragic circumstances. All told, after the 2011 outbreak, 33 people died, and nearly 150 people were sickened.
So we didn't know what would happen to the Roquefort name.
Mike Bartolo is a crop specialist with Colorado State University, based at a research station in Rocky Ford. In the months after the outbreak, Bartolo helped the growers form a trade association and establish new food safety guidelines. The group rolled out a new branding campaign and hired a public relations director.
And these guys have relied for over 100 years on that reputation of the Roquefort cantaloupe. This was a lot deeper than a business decision. This is really part of their culture and their community, and so they really stepped it up a notch to address what they needed to do.
But problems persist in the cantaloupe industry. Consumption dropped 13% last year to its lowest point in 24 years. And even with the added scrutiny after the 2011 outbreak, two other farms have distributed infected melons since then, one in Indiana, the other in North Carolina.
It's a generic problem, is that these facilities were not constructed with food safety in mind.
Food microbiologist Larry Goodrich sees common threads among these mass outbreaks. Many packing facilities use equipment that can't be easily cleaned, and washing procedures rarely follow guidelines. Water tends to be the easiest way to transfer bacteria into the flesh and rind of the melon.
So when you put all that together, we have this problem. I think we'll have to come up with ways to modify the packing houses without it costing a lot of money so that it's realistic to do.
And then they come up this. I don't think we can get back there.
But
we
back at Michael Hirakata's farm in Rocky Ford, he's just getting this year's crop in the ground. His new washing system won't be up and running until late July when the first cantaloupes are harvested. The upgrades were expensive, but worth it.
You know, it needed to be done, and it's about time it's been done, and it's a hard change, but we're working at it.
Federal food safety inspectors are visiting cantaloupe farms in 15 states this year in direct response to the recent outbreaks. Hirakata says he's likely on the short list of farms to visit, and he's more than ready to give them a tour. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues and is a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. You can find other stories or comment on this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Someone out there really likes high heels, enough to steal 100 pair of them, and police may be looking for a thief in drag. Last month, someone stole the high-heeled shoes from Latimer House, an emergency shelter for victims of domestic violence. The items were taken from a storage area located in a transitional housing development. The heels are used in the program's annual fundraiser, the Men in Heels Race. Many of the heels were unique designs in men's sizes. Unique designs in men's sizes. Latimer House officials reported the theft to the Grand Junction Police Department on April 16th. And anyone with information is asked to call police at 242-6707. Lawmakers saved one controversial bill for last on the final day of the 2013 session on Wednesday. The Senate narrowly rejected a bill to increase fines for oil and gas companies that spill fluids. When House Bill 1267 was approved in the House last month, it would have raised the maximum daily fine from $1,000 a day to $15,000. With a minimum set at $5,000 a day. When the bill left the Senate earlier this month, it raised the maximum fine to $15,000 a day, but imposed no minimum fine. A conference committee of House and Senate members met Wednesday to iron out the difference, negotiating a $2,500 a day minimum fine, but that didn't sit well with 19 senators. They drew a line in the sand, voting to reject the compromise and stick to the original version of the bill that the Senate approved. The bill's original sponsor, Representative Mike Foote, a Democrat from Lafayette, decided not to bring the matter back to the House, which effectively killed the bill. Foote said the problem is the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the state agency that oversees oil and gas drilling in Colorado. He said that 9-member panel historically has been reluctant to impose hefty fines, so having a higher limit was meaningless without a minimum. The freshman legislator said the commission far too often gives discounts to drillers that spill liquids and rarely imposes adequate fines on the industry. As a result of the bill's demise, Governor Hickenlooper signed an executive order Wednesday ordering the commission to review its enforcement penalty structure and how it imposes fines. Williams has suspended construction on a $200 million addition to its natural gas processing facility outside of Parachute. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports the company says the delay has nothing to do with a leak from a pipeline there and everything to do with sluggish local drilling. The Tulsa-based company says the project's completion is now scheduled for mid-2016. It had begun work on the project last fall with plans to put it in operation next year. The company estimates the project would have employed about 80 contract workers during peak construction. The company did not plan to increase plant employment due to the expansion. The delay comes as Williams tries to contain and clean up a leak that it estimates resulted in about 10,000 gallons of natural gas liquids leaking into soil and groundwater from a pressure gauge for a pipeline leaving the plant. The contamination has included benzene reaching nearby Parachute Creek. Tuesday's top benzene reading in the creek was 4.5 parts per billion, just shy of the state drinking water maximum standard of 5 parts per billion, although that standard doesn't apply to the creek. Williams has suspended use of the 4-inch diameter pipeline from which the liquids leaked. The company had planned to install a 6-inch diameter natural gas lines liquid in the same corridor going beneath Parachute Creek for the plant expansion. Williams previously indicated that it was possible, but unlikely, that the leak cleanup might force rerouting of the 6-inch line. Company spokesman Tom Droge said the local drilling slowdown drove the decision, and the company will be monitoring market dynamics to determine whether it might make sense to further delay the project or speed up construction. Garfield County's drilling rig count had fallen to just 7 as of the end of last year, compared to a peak of 64 in 2008. Drilling started on fewer than 500 wells in the county last year, well under a third of 2008's peak activity. Natural gas prices have begun recovering recently, and local drilling has picked up a bit this year. According to the Community Counts industry-based group, 14 rigs are now operating in western Colorado's Piceance Basin, with most of those located in Garfield County, and WPX Energy and Encana USA being responsible for most of the drilling. Williams' expansion is to create a cryogenic facility that will chill natural gas to remove more ethane, propane, butane, and other liquids that can be sold separately from gas. The new facility would allow Williams to triple the amount of barrels of liquids they can remove per day from 6,000 to 18,000. How's your internet connection?
Everyone knows when the kids come home from school around 3 o'clock, you know, the performance of their service goes way down.
The Delta County Economic Development Corporation wants to know. They're working with the Delta Montrose Electric Association on a new alternative that could be a game changer. I'll have more details about that story next week, but for now, the Delta County Economic Development Corporation invites you to participate in an online broadband survey that will give them a better view into the state of broadband in our area. You can take the survey by visiting deltacountyed.org/broadbandsurvey. I'll post that link on the KVNF website with this morning's news audio after we're done here. Stay tuned to KVNF News next week for more on the story. And finally, this week, the Black Canyon Astronomical Society takes a closer look at our closest celestial neighbor, from new to gibbous to full.
Hey, can you see the flag in that thing? It's a question that makes us wince when observing the moon at astronomy outreaches. The answer is, maybe if you were aboard NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, But all six of the flags are now faded to white, and the first one blew over when the Apollo 11 lunar module blasted off, departing the moon. From our backyards, the moon, our closest celestial neighbor, is easily observed by the unaided eye as it moves through its changing phases. During the next 2 weeks, the moon will move from new to nearly full. This Saturday, May 11th, as you look to the west, the moon will appear as a thin crescent above the bright planet Venus and below Jupiter. This is a good opportunity to see the phenomenon called Earthshine, caused by sunlight reflecting from the Earth onto the lunar night side, while the sun directly illuminates the crescent. A week later, on May 18th, the moon will be half lit by the sun at first quarter phase, meaning it is one quarter through its 29-day cycle. At this stage, by using binoculars, the lighter colored, densely cratered areas called highlands will come into view, as well as the darker maria, which are large impact basins that became filled with basalt lava, the same rock that caps Grand Mesa. Be sure to look along the terminator, which is the line between the lit side and dark portions of the moon. On May 22nd, a gibbous, or more than half, but not full moon, will appear near the planet Saturn. If you look at the southern part of the moon with binoculars, you will see the rays of the crater Tycho, which extend most of the way around the face. The bright rays are from material that was thrown out of the crater by an asteroid impact 120 million years ago, relatively recent by lunar history standards. You have been listening to Western Slope Skies, produced by members of the Black Canyon Astronomical Society. I'm Joyce Tanihara.
Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.